This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Second guest today is John Klychek. He is the author of School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education. His website is schoolworldorder.info. John has an MA in English and has taught college rhetoric and research argumentation for over 7 years. His literary scholarship concentrates on the history of global eugenics and Aldous Huxley's dystopic novel Brave New World. He is a contributor to the Intrepid Report, The Dissident Voice, Op-Ed News, News with Views, and I used to write for News with Views several years ago, starting in 2005. And he also writes for Natural News. He is also the director of writing and editing at Black Freighter Productions. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back, Deanna.
Well, it's wonderful to talk with you again. I have your book in my hand, School World Order, and you've also written recently about COVID. You wrote an article on global search, and I will put that URL in the chat room. And you were talking about the Department of Education and the way that they are using COVID-19 to finance and deregulate adaptive learning. And so could you tell us just a little bit about that?
Sure, sure. So adaptive learning software is basically a fancy name for what we might call the Skinner box or B.F. Skinner's teaching machine. So B.F. Skinner was a behavioral psychologist, and he came up with this theory called operant conditioning. It's basically just a sophisticated form of the old classical conditioning, which he also called behaviorism at another time. It's Pavlov's dog type stuff, okay? So it works on stimulus response. So with Pavlov's dog, if you give them the natural stimulus of some food, the response will be salivation. And if you associate that food with an unnatural stimulus like a bell, then you can condition the dog to have a response to the bell. You can condition the nervous system to have particular responses. B.F. Skinner basically thought that was the way you should teach people. He literally said that, with the right operant conditioning schedule, you could make a pigeon a high achiever. So he took those concepts and he put them into, what his teaching machine. You can see pictures of this up at the Smithsonian Institute. A good way to show you kind of the analog would be, if you've ever seen those old ViewMasters where.
All right.
Yeah, right. So, it's got the Disney pictures or something in the wheel. And
right.
Yeah, and you pull the slide, and then then it turns to the next image. Well, so put that instead of the pictures of the cartoon. Put question answer, short answer, multiple choice, things like that on a tape reel, and put it through a gearbox. Just before actual digital computers, it's all analog. So you turn the gear one way, you describe your answer. The stimulus is the question. Your response is your answer based on your answers. It would give you. Maybe a more challenging lesson for the next tape reel, or maybe you have to remediate. And you also, there's a reward punishment system involved. With the dog, you might give it a treat if you want it to continue doing something, or you might, punish it or spank it or something if you want it to stop doing something. So he actually had some of these machines hooked up to where they would dispense chocolate if you got a correct answer. So moving forward to today, adaptive learning software is essentially that machine. Except it's on digital windows, so instead of, gears and tape reels, it's just digital windows with clicks. Maybe has some interactive media, and the algorithms are a little more complex, but basically what they're designed to do is, data mine the students' cognitive behavioral algorithms and then track them either into maybe academic training, in one route, but you know, for the most part, it's going to try to track people into what they call career pathways, which is basically changing academics into workforce training. So it's really in some ways it's really old technology that starts with something. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. I think that this sounds very familiar, even when they began years ago to test people's IQ and then to kind of categorize the students and promote some and kind of ignore others. I think that teachers have a great deal of impact on how a student feels about their education, because we look to teachers like many people look to their doctors. They are authority figures, and so students are likely to just really take what a teacher says to heart. And a teacher can devalue or enhance a student's perception of themselves, that could last for years, decades.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wasn't always the best student, growing up. I did pretty good in college, but I was kind of one of these behaviorally difficult students. And you know, at one level, if the teacher looked at the metrics too much without, you know, taking a chance to look at the human being, sometimes I would get bored on, especially the standardized test, remember the state test, and I would just start spelling words with the multiple choice questions because I just didn't care, you know. And so if you go with that instead of looking at, is the student motivated, and, you know, is the curriculum actually teaching them something that's useful, you know what I mean, or it's not contradictory to their values, which sets up a whole paradigm where, right, they're going to resist anyways, the metrics are no good, right? And, it really goes back to something called a Project BEST, Better Education Skills Through Technology, which was leaked by Charlotte Thompson, Israel Beats.
Oh, right, yes.
Yeah, and she's been on your show a few times, so people can probably check your archives and you know, listen to her whole story. But she worked for the Department of Education under Ronald Reagan, was part of the public-private sector initiatives, and she basically saw that, you know, the Project BEST was going to put in the Skinner box through public-private partnerships, and so that would be through, today it would be big tech, would be the big tech companies, companies like K-12 Inc., which was set up by Bill Bennett, who was Reagan's Secretary of Education.
Right, yes.
And Secretary DeVos right now was a big funder of K-12 Inc. as well. So, you know, you're seeing the specific companies that came out of that movement are now setting up these new regulations. So if you look at it, it's 85 FR 18638, it's for CARES Act grants, and it has three main provisions. So one is to basically deregulate the distance learning, and that's through something called direct instruction. And then the adaptive learning is used in there several times. It refers to it as artificial intelligence. I should mention that IBM, there is a director or chair, somebody on the IBM board. I can't remember their name right now, but they're on the distance learning committee that oversees the adaptive learning stuff. And then the other part is the competency-based education, which is basically going to get rid of the 16-week semester, credit hour based, enrollment. And it's basically going to go to a subscription based enrollment through which, you know, you'll either move through your modules, your adaptive learning modules faster or slower. But as long as you keep paying the company your subscription fee, you know, you can keep trying for competence, right? Workforce competence is the
right. Yeah. Workforce. That's a key statement there.
Wow. Yeah. In the CARES, actually, there's two other CARES Act competitions. One is called Reimagining Workforce Preparation, and this is just more ways that you can get money while you're basically locked down. So, you know, while we're under the duress of, you know, the COVID lockdown, everybody's basically forced to be online right now. So we're basically forced, to incorporate this stuff in radical ways that we otherwise might have taken more time on. You know, everybody likes to say, well, it's going to go in this direction anyway. As well, you know, I mean, people, you know, like me that might have some reservations about, you know, some of this software, they're just they, you know, people see it as we're, it's a quick solution to a, you know, what hopefully is a temporary problem. And so, at some of these, you know, that's what your CARES Act money is for. The other provision is the Rethinking K through 12 Models Grant. These are competitions under the broader CARES Act grant, but the CARES Act itself, is going to give you money for technology infrastructure. But the Rethinking K-12, models is, that's most of it is for technology, infrastructure, and some of it also is for what they call, technology not yet imagined, which would be a host of, biofeedback wearables for basically students with disabilities. Wow. So.
And of course, so many students do have disabilities. And I think that's how they, how the federal government got into, the educational, field to begin with. It used to be that education was a local situation. And then all of a sudden all the school districts became corporations. And then if your classroom had somebody that had ADHD or some other situation, then they would get extra money. So then you have a lot of people who are designated as needing extra help. So it's all about money, but this CARES Act, and people can look it up and see what it talks about, but it has really used this COVID-19 situation to take, we think of it, oh, they just want to do vaccines. No, it isn't just about wanting to do vaccines.
No. No, I'm sorry, did I cut you off?
No, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, it's almost on every front. You know, oligarchs and other people that just like to capitalize on a crisis, you know, with disaster capitalists is what Naomi Klein calls them. You know,
right.
At every angle. So you've got, you know, police state stuff, right, increasing, you know, I mean, because, you know, I mean, a lockdown, you have to consider that. I mean, it's a pretty authoritarian, measure, you know, and so, you know, they got more reasons to, you know, lock people up for going to the park or cutting hair at home and things like that. Okay. And then you have, you know, the stimulus, the banks. Right? I mean, it certainly helped them get that stimulus, a lot of that stimulus money they wouldn't have got otherwise.
Oh, right. I look at this as another bailout, really. That's what's happening, is it the people that really need help because they've lost their job or their job is no longer there? They're the ones that need the help, but it's really going to the people who are already, the banks.
The yield curve. Oh, I'm so sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to add to that was to say that the yield curve on the bond markets was flattening. They were repoing the banks at, you know, billions of dollars for months before that. I mean, you know, many economists would tell you all indicators said they were going to need a bailout anyway. So, you know, it really helps when people are scared that, you know, and you can blame it on the virus, you know, not that it didn't help pop the bubble, but, you know, you can, when people are scared of that, you know, they're less concerned about, you know, whether or not you actually mismanaged, the money, you know.
Right.
But the other thing that, you know, that it adds into is what I would call the social credit. And so, you know, the adaptive learning data, you know, what we'll call the social emotional learning data that would come through the biofeedback stuff. And then another one, you mentioned the IQ stuff for your polytechnical career aptitude training. Well, there's a new thing called precision education, which wants to basically give you personalized lessons based on your genetic IQ. So whatever what they think your IQ propensity would be based on your particular DNA. So they want all of that in a particular database that we could call, you know, I would call it a social credit database. So if you looked at, you know, the Chinese system, they have a social credit system where you're given access to, you know, not just your, you know, interest rates based on how you spend money, but you get access to education, healthcare, housing, transportation. You could be put on a political blacklist all because of not just how you spend your money, but what you post online, how you behave in public in real time. And you got 3D facial recognition cameras, and your score goes up or down in real time. And, you know, I think I see that, you know, contact tracing to me is one of the first steps towards that. So another part of my book says that, so, you know, towards the end of it, through the public-private partnerships, there'll be a merger slowly bleeding together of the healthcare, education, and criminal justice. So, you know, your HIPAA records, your FERPA records, so HIPAA's for medical, FERPA's for education, and then all your criminal justice stuff, all that's going to get thrown into the same database that, you know, this big database that's, you know, look at you for pre-crime, for mental health, for career training, and basically give you a social score. So, you know, it really is, right, at every level, you know, you're seeing, you know, the education system, policing, banking, you know, all the Amazon, warehouses that got all those windfalls, those tax-free windfalls, just
right.
A few years
and
ago.
He just really needed the money, okay? The poor guy's just barely making it.
And it was good timing, huh? Real good timing.
Cause, yeah.
You know, it's only a couple of years later now, and, you know, while, again, similar example, you know, while brick and mortar schools and human teachers are locked in their houses, big tech is thriving while, you know, mom and pop stores are shut down and going bankrupt. You know, big tech is thriving, you know, Amazon and, you know, all these other companies are booming right now. So
I remember when, I wrote about it back in, under, George W. Bush, the medical records and the reason that they digitized them said, oh, well, what if you're out of town and you get sick and you need to go to a doctor? If your medical records are digitized, then the doctor can immediately look at what's wrong and be able to help you, blah, 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 blah. And really, everything that is ever presented to us is presented, it's going to be so helpful to you. When they first introduced Social Security and when they first introduced anything that they've introduced, oh, it's going to be so good for you. This is going to be helpful for you, and we're doing it for your benefit. But when you, going back to the, Trump was elected, and one of the first things he said, oh, I'm going to drain the swamp. And, if you look into the history of Betsy DeVos, and you brought her name up, she is the, current Secretary of Education. She has absolutely no background in that department. She's not necessarily, it wasn't her field, okay? And when you look at her background and you see that, she really had some other things going on, but she's known to support, school choice, school voucher programs, and, she is her brother, Eric Prince. And I think most of us know, who Eric Prince is. And she married Amway CEO Dick DeVos. And I think people know what Amway is. It was a product, you know, they went around and I don't know. They sold household products. But it was very big. I think it was a multi-level marketing kind of a situation. But anyway, her brother is Eric Prince, and he is a former U.S. Navy SEAL, and he was the founder of Blackwater. And, in fact, I have a book downstairs in my bookshelf called Blackwater. And their father is Edgar Prince. And when you look at the family, you think, gosh, and she's Secretary of Education, and think of what Blackwater, the institution, the organization, how it played in the wars in the Middle East. Oh my gosh, Blackwater is a private military company, and it was founded 1997, and just pretty close to the invasion of Afghanistan. Anyway, we'll be right back.
It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me.
Alrighty, we are back. This is Deanna, and our guest is John Klychek, and he is the author of School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education. Wow. And the website, the title is just, it says so much. It's a great title. The website is schoolworldorder.info. Now, okay, we were talking, I was running off the mouth at talking about DeVos and how this swamp drain didn't seem to go very far. It didn't go very deep because we keep finding all these swamp creatures crawling about out of the mud and mudding the water. So anyway, John.
Yeah, I can build on that a little bit because DeVos was also, she's funded, like you said, so many different nonprofits that fund corporate charter schools and voucher programs and education savings accounts, tax credits, all that types of stuff that basically funnels public dollars to pay for private, either for-profit or nonprofit charter schools, which we know, by the way, if you're the CEO of a nonprofit, there's a profit in there for you. But she not only set up and spent millions of dollars on all that stuff, but she also spent money on to help with the American Legislative Exchange Council, and even as Secretary of Education, there's press releases where she makes public announcements that she wants to keep working with them, and because they're very helpful. And one of the things that they're basically they're a law firm that writes like boilerplate laws that they send out to Congress people that help push deregulation for corporations at every level of society. But where it's significant to education is they, one of those boilerplate bills was called the Virtual Public Schools Act. And there's I've written a couple articles on it. They're linked in actually the recent article that you are putting on your website. So if you go in there and click on those links, it's in there. But the Virtual Public Schools Act is basically, is been the basis for what has set up companies like K-12 Inc., which, as I mentioned, was set up by Bill Bennett. And then DeVos, was also, buddies with Peter Thiel, who was Bill Bennett's speechwriter, okay? DeVos, I have a FOIA request in my book that shows that she met privately with him, and Peter Thiel also funds adaptive learning software. It's either Clever or Newton. It's one of those two off the top of my head. It might be both, actually. It's one or the other. The correct citation's in the book. So all these people, are shoulder to shoulder, over 30 years, or I guess it's 50 years if it was 81. 1981 was, Project BEST. And so that's what we're seeing coming to, fruition here.
Right. And it's so incremental that we just, people are busy with their lives, busy with their jobs, busy with their children, that they don't sit back and try to put all this together, because most people are good people. I think for the most part, most of us would never dream of hurting another person for profit. We would never dream of doing the things that the government, and their buddies are doing. We just wouldn't think of it. So we're naive to what others have in their mind and to the idea that people profit off of death and poor health and all the things that are coming into play. And of course you talk about Rockefeller in your book, and you talk about the DeVos Bush connection, which we're talking about. It's just amazing to me.
I thought we were going on break in a second here. So I'll just add that, the clause in the
Oh yeah, We are. We're going to go on a break in just momentarily.
Okay. Okay. So when we come back, I'll prime everybody for, I wish I had the quote, but it's a little clause in the bill that shows how they're going to let artificial intelligence evolve without regulation. And I'll break it down.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. We talked a little bit about artificial intelligence in the first hour of today's program. Oh gosh. Okay. So we're going to break momentarily, but anyway, again, the book is School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education. And people really want their children to be educated, although the education that the elites, quote unquote, offer for their children or make sure that their children have is quite different than the education that they want everyone else to have. For instance, they do not have any, okay, they do not have any, the break schedule might be off. But anyway, they do not allow their children. Okay, we'll be right back.
Reaching for a dream of peace.
With our guest today, John Klychek. He is the author of School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education. And we were talking about Secretary DeVos. And tell us a little bit about NeuroCore, which is, it's amazing how connected. Anyway, tell us about that.
Oh, no, I was going to say, go ahead, but yeah, NeuroCore is, so that would fit under the socio-emotional biofeedback wearables that will largely be used for, like, mental health, so those would fall under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, otherwise known as IDEA, and so NeuroCore basically tracks students' brainwaves, so EEGs, and they've got different treatments, so most of them are for like ADHD. So you hook the kid up to these sensors. He watches a movie or plays a video game, and if he loses concentration, you know, if his ADHD takes over, then you know, based on his brainwaves, his or her brainwaves, it'll stop the game, or it'll pause the game. So then or the movie, and it'll require the student, right? Once it shows that he or she's showing attention again, right? Then that's supposed to, with that biofeedback, it's supposed to train. And by the way, if you notice, if you didn't pick it up, it's based on the same stimulus response, mechanism that BF Skinner. It's just
right,
instead of the stimulus being external where it requires some level of, cognition or thinking, it literally is triggering you at the base neurological level. And that's just one of many companies. So she was once, on the board of it, but when she became Secretary of Education, she stepped down from the board, but she's still one of is heavily invested in the company.
Right. She didn't sell her shares. She just left the board because she was really asked to. And if nobody had asked her to, she probably would still be there. So it's conflict of interest, my gosh. And of course, that's the way it always is with politicians, whether they're, Secretary of Defense or whatever. You can bet that they are making money off of their political decisions where regular people go to Washington to serve, quote unquote, as our representatives. They go as regular people, come back millionaires, and you have to ask yourself, well, how did that happen? What's going on here? And, but she didn't go as a pauper. She started out as a millionaire and is going to stay that way while she is corrupting, our children.
And there's ethical reasons by themselves why you don't want to just give companies a green light to literally do whatever they want without repercussion. But you know, when the people that are deregulating the laws are people that literally seek to directly benefit from the companies that would benefit from the deregulation, I mean, that's just like, not just red flag. It's obvious. It should be. But you know, there's other companies that are similar to that. I mean, she's just one in a big basket. So the other one is, there's another one called BrainCo, which tracks EEGs. It's way down in my Twitter feed, but I'm at Professor Dallas or Dallas Professor at Professor Dallas, one or the other. I always get mixed up. And you can see the kids wearing these headbands, and it works the same way, but it's for other, you know, focus, attention, you know, and that's a Chinese company, actually. It's funded by one of the major state-owned, corporations in China. And then, you know, there was there's other biofeedback wearables to help students, you know, under the premise of, helping students with disabilities and other cognitive issues. So the Gates Foundation had the, galvanic skin response monitors, which were, you know, or GSR monitors, and these things were these bracelets that the kids wear, and it, based on your skin conductivity, again, it shows, are you paying attention? Do you like what the teacher's saying? Does it irritate you? Are you going to sleep? Things like that. Yeah. And, you know, by the way, you know, we just talked about, so what's that, you know, how is COVID-19, you know, ramping this up? Because I'm sure most people probably have noticed, you know, on TV or whatever advertisements they get on any kind of feed that you have, I'm sure you've seen, pitches for mental health, stuff and apps to help you with it. So these meditation apps, the prayer apps, the Fitbits, these exercise bits.
Yes.
Yeah, it's all based on these same mechanisms where they're looking at heart rate, skin conductivity, brain waves, EEG, et cetera, in order to, you know, help you either with focus, calming down, or, you know, exercising. And, you know, by the way, if any of those apps, so that's at the commercial level, and then they just have another branch they're supposedly for helping you learn. If you download any of those for free, don't think that they're not taking that data and selling it or sharing it in some way.
So. Oh, absolutely. Just every time you do anything on the computer, anytime that you are tracked anywhere, as far as having a GPS in your car, a GPS on your wrist, oh my gosh, what are people thinking? I'm aghast that people don't recognize that this is a problem. This is really, really a problem. Why would anybody allow themselves to be tracked? Or do they realize it? Or do they care? Or are people that naive?
There is a large section of people that are not aware of, certainly not the magnitude of, you know, how ubiquitous the data mining is. And I can say this anecdotally, based on the number of students, because this is a topic that, you know, I don't think every student should be aware of, right? You know those phones you guys use? Do you ever wonder why when you're on Facebook, or you're looking up, you know, these shoes or this video game on another website, when you go on your Facebook, an ad pops up for that stuff, and they're like, yeah, there's many of them that go, yeah, I did wonder that, and, you know, so there's a lot of them that learn it in the class. And then, you know, I teach community college, so it's not just people in their, you know, late teens, early 20s. You know, there's a lot of people that go back to school that are older than me. I'm 36. Am I 37 yet? No, I'm 36. And so, you know, a lot of those people sometimes are, you know, not entirely aware. But, you know, that's, you know, I say, well, why do you think it's free? How do you think these companies run? How do you think Facebook is basically one of the biggest companies in the world, and everything Facebook does is basically free, right? You know, and that gets back to, you know, what I was going to mention about, you know, how they're deregulating the AI in the 85 FR1 and 638 distance learning deregulations. And basically what they say is this, you know, AI, you know, the adaptive learning algorithms are evolving faster than we can come up with regulations and legislation for. So in order to basically get out of the way of progress, like you said earlier, you know, in order to help you, we're going to go ahead and we're not going to penalize any companies or any schools that decide they want to move forward with a new algorithm without our prior approval. Okay. And as we just mentioned that, right, this ubiquitous data mining, which means that, you know, it's taking data from you in order to personalize the lessons. So that means that basically it's learning from you as well. Right? It has to be able to do that. So it works both ways. And those things are learning way faster than you. So at the end of the day, you're really, as much as you might gain from it, you're building AI. And so, you know, when they talk about adaptive learning AI, this is what they call dumb AI. So they're pretty sophisticated algorithms, but they're not conscious. They're not what they call artificial general intelligence, which is, would be a machine that can basically, mimic human consciousness, you know, have volition, you know, make spontaneous decisions and things like that. So basically, what they want to do is, you know, all that data is going to be aggregated through machine learning, larger machine learning pools, and they'll take that cognitive behavioral data from the adaptive learning software, the socio-emotional learning data from the mental health biofeedback, and then all of the IQ data and from the gene data. They'll run that through a machine through the different stages of your psychological development. So if you've ever taken a psych class and, you know, you got like Vygotsky and all these different theories about stages of development, Erikson, Piaget, right? They're going to put them into models that basically use those frameworks, put all this individualized data over the course of a young man or woman, you know, a little boy all the way to, you know, through lifelong learning. And based on that data, they're going to try to come up with, that's what they're going to use to get their AGI. Right? So because if you see something like Sophia, it looks like a human, talks like a human, and it still gets stuck in these weird loops. It's not really conscious. And so all that data mining, you know, is all of it together is going to be used to build something that, you know, for post-humanism. And that was one of the terms I used in the article.
Wow. That's mind-boggling. Yes. And what you were saying about across the board, if you order from a company, I ordered some garments from a company, and I got them, and they looked great on the internet, but I didn't like them. I didn't like the feel of them, so I returned them. But I would go and visit another site, and I would see every single thing that I ordered. Five things. I saw all five of those things at another website, and I'm thinking, holy cow, this is amazing that they knew exactly what I had ordered. And I don't participate in Facebook. I did initially. I thought, oh, this is nice to keep in touch with my family, but it was very time consuming, very artificial. I viewed it as a CIA operation. I do participate in Twitter. That's the only thing that I do. And I don't have a GPS in my car because they're tracking every move you make. Every move you make, whether you're walking, whether you're running, whatever you're doing. And of course they pretend that, oh, this is going to help you if you get lost, out in the country somewhere. If you get lost, you'll be able to find your way home. But what else is that it is doing? Well, I have a t-shirt that says use it or lose it. It has a picture of a brain on it. People used to remember how to get around. And when I was on the road, I was a textile salesperson, and I had a big map, and I would kind of chart my travels. I traveled in five different states, and so that I knew exactly where I was going all the time. I got lost a few times, but I knew whether I was going north or south or west or east. And when you have these instruments, you don't have to remember phone numbers, because if you have a cell phone, which I don't use a cell phone, but if you have a cell phone, you have all the numbers in there. All you have to do is punch the name. So you're not remembering the things that you used to know automatically. And if you're not using it, you're losing it, because we're not expecting ourselves or demanding of ourselves that we use our brain, because we have all these, all this technology that, as you said, we don't have to think about things because they're going to tell us what to think about, or this artificial intelligence. Well, I want my own intelligence. I don't want artificial. I prefer the real thing.
Well, Elon Musk, you know, because he's way smarter than me or you, he says that, you know, your devices are already an extension of your memory. It's not taking over your memory. So when he gives you Neuralink, it's just what he's doing is instead of you having your extension of your memory in your hand, it's straight in your brain, and you can do what Facebook calls a brain click. It's literally their term for virtual reality. And you can, you know, so you can just literally download information like Ray Kurzweil says, chief engineering at Google. And you know, you won't have to worry about them. You'll literally interface with it. You know, and he says, by the way, that a bunch of that stuff is to help you with paralysis, you know, with the disabilities again.
Well,
paralysis,
of course. They always make it a benefit to us. Whatever. Anything that they've ever imposed on us is for our benefit. If they were truthful and actually told you exactly what they were doing as far as this data mining and whatever, we would resist. Or at least we should resist.
Yeah, and the other part is that, you know, like you said, with the data mining, well, he tells you on his press release, you know, it was a few months back, that the Neuralink will literally link to a Bluetooth on your phone, an app on your phone. So, you know, so if it's data mining on your phone, it's going to data mine the chip that's linked to your phone. All right. You know, so, he says it'll help you to compete with AI. So, you know, like when I said, when this adaptive learning starts to get smarter than you, you know, basically he's helping you because otherwise it's going to surpass you. And so this is why you're going to need it to compete with it and to live with it. But, you know, like you said, my question would be, well, why don't we just not build it? Then we don't have to, you know, worry about having to compete with it. That sounds like a good idea too, right? But, or at least let's actually regulate it as it evolves, maybe, if you want me to be more, more, I guess,
and who's gonna regulate it? Who's gonna regulate all this? Where's individual choices? Where's independence? Where's all the other things that this country was built upon? Individual work, individual progress, individuality. What about all that?
Well, it's all based on the latest empirical model, the latest big data model, right? If we want to go by the Fauci method of what we're supposed to do. And, you know, just to throw this out here, you know, there's many reasons to be worried about, you know, privacy and public health rights and human rights for forced medication of anything, because that violates the Nuremberg Code to begin with. But let everybody know that if they can, under the guise of public health, forcibly inoculate you, forcibly stick something in your body, then they've already set the precedent that for mental health purposes, they can give you a brain chip, which Elon Musk just recently said he's ready for human trials on. Okay? So it will set the legal precedent, regardless of, you know, how far you want to go with what's in the vaccine. Legally, I can guarantee you that if they get that right to do that, it'll spread. And Oliver Wendell Holmes once used a local vaccine, law, I can't remember the name of it, it's pretty famous, to basically say that, yeah, forced vaccination also allows us to do forced sterilization on Kerry Buck.
Right, right. I remember reading about that. And what was the famous words that he said?
Three generations of imbeciles are
right.
Enough. Yep.
Yes. Oh, gosh. Okay, we're going to a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest is John Klychek. He is the author of School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education. And we will take calls in the next hour at 800-313-9443. John's website is schoolworldorder.info. And this is really scary. This is really scary. And of course the taxpayers, and the people who used to, well, they still fund the schools, but I remember when my children were in school, I participated in PTA and volunteered whenever I could. And I just felt, I felt that school was at that point a pretty safe place. But I don't know. You really have to rethink all of this. And now with the COVID-19 and, another way of education, getting it through, as you describe in the book, getting it digitally. And I've had a few meetings recently, Zoom meetings, and, I'm planning on another Zoom meeting in about a month. It's as if people have accepted this as a reality. And I think, gosh, I think people are accepting the idea too readily that this is an ongoing type of existence. What do you use? Go ahead.
I think that it's normal for a lot of people to feel powerless when large institutions, big business, big government, you know, the National Guard, governors, right, say you can't do stuff. But, start with little things first. Just start with little things first. And that means go to a school board meeting, or, you know what I mean? Say, hey, I heard that adaptive learning software is not so good for the kids. I mean, you know, and as you do that, you'll see that you can actually get some small effects, and then that grows and you make a bigger change, and because before doing a lot of this, I kind of felt, even as a teacher, the same way. And, I kind of wiggled my way into one of these CARES committees. And so, not everybody's bad. There's a lot of other administrators and teachers on there that are receptive. I mean, there's a lot of people that probably just think that it's all good and helping people. Let's get the best software we can, you know, whatever they say, the most expensive, and plug it in. But, there's ways we cannot be powerless. There's small ways, you know, so just make some connections, you know, with your teachers, parents, you know, and then build out from there.
All right. excuse me. Well, just, excuse me. Just the introduction of computers in the schools. It seemed like, I don't know, maybe 12 years ago, 15 years ago, that they introduced computers into the schoolroom. And so I think it's been kind of incremental that now parents think, oh, well, my gosh, we have to have either a tablet for our child, or they have to have a computer, or else the school isn't up to date. And people aren't reading books anymore. They're taking education from the Internet. Now, I have a lot of Kindle books, but I have a lot of hard books too.
Well, and teachers, you know, I think, or, well, teachers, probably some teachers too, but parents, I think, like you said, they look to, schools are for teaching, which means, you know, teachers are there to help your kids, and they all have degrees, and they went through all the training and the certification. So, you know, they're the authorities and they're the experts, so you can trust them. And technology is the smartest stuff that there is, right? Because computers are just so precise, and they never fail. So a teacher with a computer, you can trust that and kind of step, bow out of the equation.
Oh gosh.
That's what people think, right?
How awful. Alrighty, we will be right back, and we will take phone calls at 800-313-9443. Be right back. Our guest is John Klychek. He's the author of School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education. We're talking about schools, and the thing that I have noticed is that children don't know how to write anymore. We did a lot of writing when I was going to school. We had to do reports. We had to do essays. We had to do all kinds of we did a lot of input, and we had to learn how to write, and we learned the exercises that showed us how to do cursive. It was just very very interesting. But now children are not even being taught how to write cursive.
Yeah, that, you know, that kind of touches on, you know, some of the solutions that I had come up with. I mean, I had a 5-point plan. Some of it has to do with governance. Some of it has to do with methodology. Some of it has to do with digital privacy. But then other parts had to do with, you know, basically the philosophy of education. And I wanted to, you know, my solution was, you know, go back to a classical method, a classical education. You know, what's sometimes called the trivium, so grammar, logic, and then rhetoric. And, you know, in the trivium, grammar is broken into special grammar and general grammar. So special grammar is basically what we might today call linguistics. Back then they would have called it philology, but it basically just means the alphabets and the sentence structure that you use for a specific language. So it's language specific. But then the general grammar has to do with the vocabulary of any given subject that you're going to study. So that's subject specific. So, you know, the general grammar for, you know, geography has a general grammar. That would be the land masses and things like that. You know, mathematics has its own, you know, arithmetic has its own, general grammar. That would be the numbers, you know, and then difference between a sum and a product and things like that. And that is the same, that those refer to objective things in reality, regardless of what language you're using. The symbols in the language might change, but they refer to the same thing. Now, you know, what I just said probably sounds super formal. People probably just, you know, most people probably think grammar is just, you know, subject-verb agreement and stuff like that. But, you know, it's the ability, grammar in the old classical method is the ability to name the categories of the mind and the categories of reality. And then logic is the part where you put that grammar together in ways that don't contradict. Rhetoric is where you can express it in ways that don't contradict. And since, like George Orwell said, thinking is basically language, you have to basically dialogue with yourself. You know, rhetoric is also a process by which you weed out the contradictions in your own thoughts. So that's the way that you self-learn. It's also the way that you weed out contradictions in corporations and government. And this is the ability, right? We call this truth. We call this truth in the classical method. But in the postmodern world, the deconstructionists basically say that, you know, the grammar, everything is relative, basically, including grammar. So they actually don't spend time teaching grammar. They call it skill and drill. You might get a little bit of special grammar early on, but if you don't pick it up by third or fourth grade, they do what's called whole language learning. And basically they stop diagramming sentences. And so that's why, you know, when I teach at the community college level, I get many people that come in that really need that special grammar training. But they, pedagogically, the staff and department, they frown on it.
Right.
Don't waste your time with that. Yeah.
But I think that's really important. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and there is data that shows, because I would try to sneak it in, and there is data that shows that, you know, once the student's thinking has already been, so, you know, another thing that makes a good writer is, you know, what they might call code switching. So being able to change from your speaking language to your written language. And my written language is sounds a lot less casual than this. It might be a little dense. But so if you don't, so there's the other part. If you don't develop that metacognition, so that the introspection to be able to look in and say, okay, I'm in a different situation, or I'm in a different audience, I need to speak, or I need to structure my ideas differently, or I'm on paper, so I need to do so. They say that, you know, if you lose that, or if you don't gain that code switching ability, that all that special grammar, the skill and drill actually doesn't equate to when they try to write, because when they write, they revert to how they think, and that's already garbled from years of not giving them the proper training to begin with. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't go back and do that, because I've worked with a lot of international students. And one of my best friends in college was from Nepal, and so, you know, he would always, I mean, like, just always pick my brain about grammar. And in a lot of ways, you know, I could tell him, like, you know, what's, I could tell him, well, just, we would say it like this, but he could tell me the grammar rules better, and he could diagram sentence, and, you know, so it's, what I'm saying is that he's an adult, he was in his 30s as well, you know, that means that you can actually learn special grammar with it. So there's, you know, that's, they want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. And, you know, that's, no, that, I think it, because it largely fits into their larger philosophical paradigm, which, you know, we might call deconstructionism. It's rabid skepticism, basically, but it, you know, it branches out of rabid induction, rabid empiricism, which is, you know, basically the Fauci method of, right, you know, our data says so, you know, right. Even though your data is always incomplete, so you're always, you know, they always want to operate outside of what their data can actually say, and this is where you get into what's called skepticism, right? So if we say the truth is basically, you know, when the words we use in our mind and in our mouth don't contradict with how we act and what's objective in reality, you know, the empiricists, you know, would go, you know, beyond their models to say, you know, to even say that, well, the categories of the mind and the categories of reality don't have to correspond, and certainly the categories of your mind don't have to fit to the categories of reality. We can change reality to fit the categories of our mind and the categories of our model because we're the authorities, and that's
right.
That's the larger paradigm.
Right. We do have a caller. We have Brian in Washington. Why don't we take Brian? Brian?
Hello. I would like to ask your guest what he knows about the word communitarianism.
So you know, it's very much along the lines, I would call it a branch of, you know, socialism or communism. It fits into Agenda 21 or Agenda 2030, that type of stuff, and it's the idea, public-private partnerships fit very much into it. And it's kind of what we're seeing, you know, with the COVID stuff. It's that your individual rights have to be subordinated to the community. But what is the community? The community is the public-private partnerships, and then you have the authorities of the governments and the businesses that are at the top of that. Rosa Quarry, who writes a brilliant work on the things behind the green mask on that, she can do it. She can explain it much better than I, but I think that's the gist of it.
Okay, so very good. Follow this thing in the Pacific Northwest. There was a summit about trying to stop the 5G in Vancouver, and I noticed that Dr. Patrick Wood was given a opportunity to attend, and he talks a lot about technocracy. But that was my question to these people. How come the other side of this discussion, that being the communitarian aspect, is always superseded by technocracy? I saw that was mentioned in your book, and at your age, I would love to see you look into it a little further, and definitely don't use Rosa Quarry as your source of information. I believe her to be controlled, but you know, we're going to put some links in the chat, and we'd love to have Deanna have you back on in a week or two. And at your age, you could write another book giving this a fair amount of your time. That would be my encouragement. The reason why this has been really important, I mean, Deanna has had Lark on several times. He's called a dozen times into her show. She has given Lark a lot of airtime, but what is going on right now is the governor of California is using the word community spirit. In other words, this virus has to do with, you know, the responsibility to the community that you obey these rules. So that's one aspect of it. But Amitai Etzioni is recently interviewed, and he is saying, yeah, we take the lessons we learned in Israel on how to deal with terrorists, and we can apply it to this virus. He's an advisor to every president since Carter. So this Professor Amitai Etzioni is no small entity. And his son is Oren Etzioni in Seattle, who is high-level instigator of all of this smart driving cars. And
oh.
All the five. So I'm really interested, you know, that I get that across. And you're, like I said, you're guest could look into it and maybe come back on the show and say, holy crap, because, you know, there is a concerted effort to quell this subject. If Breiser, who broadcasts out of Ireland every week, and he keeps bringing up the word, and he is discouraged, and there was a Irish woman, her name is Fiona Marie Flanagan, and initially she was buddying up with him a month ago and using the, no, it's communitarianism. But then 2 weeks ago it became communitarian / communism, and now it's communism. So somebody got to her. You got a couple of nice children. Do you want them to have a mother? Well, I guess she decided they do. So that, I don't want to take up all your time. I'm sure you got other calls.
John, what's your response?
Well, thank you for that. I mean, so to tell you the truth, you know, the reason why I brought her up was because I listened to her. She popped up on my feed a few times recently, and I just noticed, in the book, it sounds like you've read it or you've looked at it. I didn't, you know, I largely looked at, you know, technocracy, right? To me, you know, I also looked at the Hegelian dialectic, right? And so, you know, I call it communism sometimes, but certainly I think I lean more towards calling it, you know, corporate fascism. I didn't look at this, all the sustainability stuff and all, but the communitarian part, you know, going back to what I just said about, you know, the manipulation of grammar, logic, and rhetoric, I do think that these words can be switched around quite a bit. I'm totally happy to look into more of what you're talking about. Just to kind of lend some credence to what you're saying, I'll say that, you know, in education, if I'm trying to persuade people in the system to try to, you know, buck back against this and maybe, you know, stand up for our rights, it helps to use the grammar that is more persuasive to, I guess, a lot of people that I guess we would call left of persuasion. And so, you know, I largely felt like I would get more people in academia to hear the message, but I'm not at all averse to using that word or to looking into it more and to incorporating it into more of my analysis. Yeah.
Good on you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much, Deanna.
And I'll definitely check it out. Yep.
Good, good.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you. Okay. Good call from Brian. And yes, that is really something that he brought that up, that we need to band together as communities, and everything that that communitarianism has been doing for a number of years is trying to get people into banding together and to accepting things that they wouldn't ordinarily accept without some sort of a traumatic event, which, of course, we have. And I just never, I've been thinking so much about vaccines, the Gates vaccine, and we've been thinking so much about Bill Gates and what he's trying to do. We're thinking of this really, really big picture when, in fact, it might be the little picture that we need to be looking at and evaluating that.
Yeah, and to build, just to go back to what I said a little bit more, you know, I mean, because it does build on what I had said right before I came on, which is, you know, the the weaponization of language, or the confusion of the ability
right.
to use language and the ability to think and speak. And I'll throw this out there. Charlotte Iserby, she sent me an email today, saying, watch out for community-oriented policing system, which would be definitely under the communitarian branch. And she's saying it, why? Because probably, her research is saying that what's going to be, we're looking at the riots right now, from the horrible, situation that happened. And, she's looking at it as that the solution will be community-oriented police. Like, so it'll sound like the people are going to be able to have more access to review when this stuff happens, right? That it'll be more public, that they'll have
right.
direct access to oversight of when something like this happens, and they'll be able to, weed these types of officers out faster and things like that. But what my research shows, and this goes back to why I like to, especially when I'm talking to people of a left persuasion, because it is also it's a public-private partnership. It involves public-private partnerships, which means, there's going to be some private companies in there. And I think one of the ways that you can get people left of persuasion to realize that something's bad, like if you call it communitarianism, they'll just emotionally have an attachment to it. But if you show them that, look, dude, like you guys are all about anti-corporation or corporatism, this is corporatism under the, called communitarianism. It's communo-fascist. And,
right.
So that's that, that's why I would, use that term sometimes. But, at the same time, you need to be able to see through that word as well, right? You need to be able to not just, kind of look at the other side, but you need to be able to see through the wordplay, yeah.
Right. And there is a lot of that. Of course there's a lot of that. you have been doing a lot of, discussing emergency COVID-19 deregulations and restructuring, and that's what we've been talking about. And all of this restructuring could not have occurred without this big event. And yet when we talk about the the actual virus itself, if you have a cold is a coronavirus. And so people just accepted this word, and they've blown it up. As I said, I haven't watched TV, but I do know that they've made it into this very serious situation where people are wearing masks and all kinds of it. And I see people driving by themselves in their car with a mask on, and I think that these people are nuts. They're absolutely nuts. It just shows you how gullible and naive people are, that they're not doing some studying, that they get all of their information from the TV. And if you go back, I'm not sure what year they did this, that they wanted to make sure that everybody had a specific type of television. When you're watching TV, I know this sounds conspiratorial, but who's watching you? Go ahead.
No, you're talking about the smart. I thought you were talking about the Hertz waves, the frequency rate at which the flicker.
Either
rate,
way.
Yeah, both, right? I mean, both together. With the wordplay stuff, it goes back to, confusing. There are many contradictions in how they report these numbers, everything from, death with to death from, meaning did you get the acute respiratory system failure or some other complication, what type of coronavirus did you get tested for, did you actually get diagnosed, was it telehealth, did they do a test, was the test contaminated?
And how quickly did they develop this test? It's ridiculous. It's totally ridiculous. Alrighty, we are going to a quick 3-minute break, and we are accepting phone calls at 800-313-9443. Be right back.
It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me.
All righty, we are back. I just love that song. It's just a really wonderful song. It was donated to me by a wonderful listener, and it's just I just love that music, the song, the words, the thoughts. Alrighty, our guest is John Klychek. He is the author of School World Order: The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education. His website is schoolworldorder.info. And we do have another caller, Chris, near Las Vegas. Chris, welcome.
Well, thank you so very much, Deanna, and thanks for having Don on. He's a wonderful guest with great knowledge, and I really appreciate some of the areas he specializes in. He had made some mention of mental health earlier, and with his comments on grammar, logic, and the other aspect he spoke of, I have to point out that the word term mental is under the doctrine of void pervades. It's arbitrary and capricious and very dangerously malleable to mean anything they want it to mean. Much like the DSM, the Diagnostic Symptoms Manual for all of the psychiatric and so-called mental health trades, most of the words are vague and ambiguous in there and have no defined meaning with which you can make any sense of anything in there at all. As to what it is, it's whatever they want to mean when they're trying to apply it to you, and you got to be able to nail them down on the specificity lack it has in order to defeat their allegations.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know what version they're on now, but that kind of lends some credence right away to, you know, the non-standardization. The other part is that, you know, it basically comes out of the eugenics as well, right? And so, you know, some of it they might, you know, link to these algorithms or your DNA or other things. But, you know, I think at one point, like you mentioned, OD, is it the oppositional defiant disorder? I believe at one point they said it was like if you were questioning the government or something like that, that could be a symptom of that. And, yeah, and then you only need to check off certain boxes. You know, you don't have to, you know, they have a wide range of symptoms, and, you know, some of them, you know, if we might look at them in terms of like values dispositions as opposed to, you know, some sort of neurological or other, you know, brain disorder, you know, something that you might be able to demonstrate with, biological or physical health. I mean, we might think of these as just, you know, disagreeing with the weird paradigm that we live in.
And that's really true. Yeah, what you bring up is really true. I think they're on the fifth DSM now. So if we're skeptical about what's going on, if we're skeptical about what the government is saying, then obviously we have a mental disease that we need to be treated for. And when you look at the numbers of people who are on psychiatric drugs, and I really don't like psychiatric drugs. I think that, well, I don't like prescription drugs to begin with, for a number of reasons. All of them have side effects. And, but they really want to get more people on psychiatric drugs. Now I say they might be beneficial in some cases, but when you look at the numbers, you have to really question this, particularly children who are on Ritalin, because they're disruptive in class, and usually it's boys. But boys don't like to sit still. That's because they're boys. And children need recess. They need time to run around. They need to be active. And when you're sitting them in a classroom and droning on and on, they're going to get disruptive. So you bring up a good point.
They even have digital prescriptions now as well. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, sir.
Oh, yeah.
That's quite right.
what I was going to suggest is, of course, we know that most of the suicidal psychotropic so-called specialty drugs are crafted particularly, and they're fundamentally based upon methamphetamine sulfate, what we know as speed. And so finding that they have deleterious and dangerous side effects is something that's not unexpected for the somewhat informed. And I think that what we see is the psychiatric trade has been coupled up or at least strongly affected by the legal trade and their twisting of word terms to their own predatory advantage and leaving them vague and nebulously undefined specifically so they can twist them into anything they want. And I don't know, I got a little background, but thanks so much, and I appreciate your guests very much, Dan. You got a great choice there. Bye-bye.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chris. That was interesting.
And you know, I'll just add that, you know, so as I mentioned before, you know, if they get the right to give you a vaccine for the sake of public health, then they can also give you any number of mental health treatments, whether digital or otherwise, for the sake of public health. But this also leads towards, you know, the creation of the new human or the new man, meaning transhumanism. So they have the right to do whatever they want with your body as they see it for the benefit of the state.
Right. Wow. Okay, we'll be right back.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me.
All righty. We are back. And our guest is John Klychek. He is the author of School World Order, The Technocratic Globalization of Corporatized Education. Love that title. It says so much. The website is schoolworldorder.info, and we are taking phone calls at 800-313-9443. We do have a couple callers. Did you want to respond to anything before we take callers?
No, I think I responded pretty good to the last couple.
Yeah, I think, well, yes, Matt, you did.
All right.
I just don't want to cut your time short.
No.
Okay, great.
Yeah, both calls, yeah.
Okay, but let's take Tom in Utah. Tom?
Am I connected?
You're connected. You're well connected.
Okay.
Yep.
Actually, I'm going to put dittos on everything he's been talking about. What's really interesting, of course, my professional education was in the 50s and 60s, but about the mid-70s, we felt I noticed a radical change. And what's interesting in the last half of my professional career, I was, as I would go and I would lecture or present to medical classes through about 32 different universities that I've covered in the last three decades. Sometimes you give the students a fact, you know, reproducible in the laboratory, and their eyes glaze over. I began to realize that they're being educated in a kind of a cubicle type of educational format. You know, you'll go to a specialist. They know a lot about their specialty, but they can't see the continent for the tree. They're so close to their specialty, they can't see outside of it, so they don't understand the total picture. And it makes it easy for them to be manipulated. And the same thing goes for the public. We've been so, dumbed down, that we can't see the whole picture. When it's given to us, it seems so foreign. And that's what's worried me with these kids. They're not learning how to write. You were talking about that, Deanna. They don't know how to write script or write the cursive. So they don't even think in the constructive mentality that's required for writing. You just hit a button and that's, you know, gives them a letter and they're on their way. There seems to be a mental process that's required when you're writing things out in cursive writing. And it's sad that I am seeing the kids coming out. They don't even know how to write their name in cursive. So they don't think, or don't, they don't have the thought processes that were, that that cursive actually demanded of you.
The brain connections, the neurons aren't connecting. And we talked earlier too about, when you learn something new, your brain is wired. It grows. It makes new connections. What is it called? Anyway, go ahead with what you were saying. But it just creates more diversity in your brain. As I said earlier, you don't use it, you lose it.
Yeah, when you're, if I can just jump in, when you're penciling, when you're scribing the letter, you're tracing the shape of the letter as you're writing the word, as you're making the sound in your head. And so you're making connections between what that symbol looks like, what it feels like to trace it, and what the actual meaning is associated with it, in reality. And, you know, this goes back to the stimulus response stuff. It's, you know, they want to bypass all of that, all those interconnections, and just have like I said, you click a button, and then, you know, you're, and so if you're a good typer, and I'm pretty good, you know, you're not looking at the keys, you know, you're not thinking about what that letter is shaped like or what the vowel sounds are and things like that. And, you know, it, as you mentioned, you know, so they don't just compartmentalize how your mind works with relation to the language you use, but they compartmentalize the knowledge itself. And that goes back to the Pavlov's dog. So, you know, that's why they have bells, ring bells in between classes. So you ring a bell and that tells the students, okay, math is over. Turn that part of your brain off. Now English time has nothing to do with math. Turn that part on. I should add that the trivium used to have a quadrivium, which we basically call it the study of the number. You know, you call it the classical sciences. So, but they went together, you know, grammar, logic, rhetoric, and then the other four classical liberal arts, went together. You know, when I often go and I'll ask people in the department that are experts just to make sure if I'm doing research and I'm reading stuff. Like, let me ask a PhD in this, you know, and they'll be like, yes or no. But then like the gentleman said, if I try to extrapolate out, you know, like connect it to another discipline, they're like, oh, you need to go ask, you know, Dr. So-and-so about that. And, I recently, somebody tweeted me, and this is what Twitter and social media can be good for, because people send me some good research that wouldn't be on my radar otherwise. He said that he went to the doctor recently, and the doctor basically, it sounded like adaptive learning software. He kept apologizing to the gentleman saying, I'm sorry, I can't finish the diagnosis until I ask you these questions and click these boxes. And so they're forcing even doctors to think inside, not just these, you know, the stimulus response thing, but, you know, in the actual machine, the stimulus response inside a very narrow algorithm. Yeah.
Okay, what I was trying to remember, Dr. Joe Dispenza says, neurons that fire together, wire together.
Wire, yeah.
I like that.
And that's true. And we're not firing together. We're just, and Tom, you brought up the holistic. People are specializing, so they're not looking at the human being as a whole person. That one is a expert at one thing, and some you have another expert. When if you fail to look at the whole person, to when you're trying to figure out what's causing their issues, it's just you're leaving so much out. And very few doctors now go into primary care. They want to specialize.
And I think what they want is so that literally, you know, if they get enough, you know, go move a couple of generations down when, you know, everybody that learned before these doctors, they also had to do it on these modules. And there is no, you know, elders that can say, yeah, we used to do it a different way without the machine. I mean, you know, it's not so far-fetched to think that, you know, that the doctor won't be able to diagnose without it, or that you won't be able to calm yourself down without your Calm app, because you're so used to, and your dad and your mom and grandma, everybody was so used. That's the only way you know how to pay attention to your biorhythms or whatever, you know, abstract concept is through the computer, through what the computer tells you about it.
Wow. Interesting. Okay, Tom.
Thank you if we can keep you ignorant, we keep you dependent.
Oh, how true.
And scared.
Yes, how true.
And scared, you bet. Anyway, yes. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Tom, for your contribution. Appreciate it. Okay, let's take Mark in Philadelphia. Mark, welcome.
Hello, Deanna. Thank you for receiving my call. Thank you for having your guest. And thank you for doing your part to help, again, challenge us to rearrange the furniture in our brains. On that note, we've been, basically the American public for multiple generations have been mesmerized. Call it mass hypnosis. A lot of people are going along to get along because they have to, and they get distracted easily. The people that are behind this, the original Star Trek, I remember Star Trek with Spock, and I remember first coming upon when he would play three-dimensional chess. Well, the evil people that are bringing this to us are playing 10-dimensional chess, and they're hammering us at every level, multiple across the board. This is mesmerization of not only the human mind, but to try to disconnect us from our souls. You know, the part of us, the aspect of our being that connects with real wisdom of the earth, you know, of God, whoever mm-hmm. God is to a person. See? So I'd like to jump forward a little bit because your guest here is a teacher. Let's go to Snoopy. Charlie Brown. Wah 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 wah. Remember that teacher in front?
Yeah. Oh, that was the teacher. I thought that was the mom, but okay.
Yeah, so the teacher. So what's wah? So people are listening to that and they're not really paying attention. That's what's going on with this right now, Deanna. A lot of people are not paying attention. They're getting diverted, distracted. Hammered in a lot of different ways. This whole coronavirus baloney, we're told all the enemy's China. Oh, no, the enemy's Russia. Oh, the enemy's Iran. Well, how about the group of people who have infiltrated our government for over 100 years? Now, they would promote themselves as being good people and trying to do the right thing, including the mayor and the governor, the mayor of Minneapolis and the governor of Minnesota. What group are they connected with? Let's just call them tribal. Okay? Mm-hmm. So back to wah, 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 wah. Let's spell it out. W-A-A-W. We are at war. People need to take this seriously. It's been a subtle war for a long while, and now they want to bring it and put it in our faces. They want to force these vaccinations on us. They want to force our behaviors. They're destroying the heart of the American economic model, the heart of the economy, which is mom and pops. I grew up in southern Missouri, and in a mom and pop restaurant business, and the mom and pops are the heart of the economic engine of this nation. And so what are they doing? They're shutting it down. And what, the corporatists and the banksters? See? So I'll leave you with that. This is mesmerization, and people got to wake up and stop giving in and learn how to say no. If you can't say no and mean it, your yeses don't mean a damn thing. Learn how to practice saying no. Everybody out there listening, just in simple ways, practice saying no. Say no. Call up whoever and just tell them, no, I'm not doing it. Practice it. You know, I'll leave you with that. Thank you, Deanna.
Thank you very much, Mark.
There's riots all over the country right now. And so, I gotta say, you know, you're right. Civil disobedience is correct. Because all the power that they have is, like you said, it's basically, you know, voodoo. It's basically magic. It's basically a bunch of lies which is untruth, and untruth doesn't exist. It's not real. So what makes it real is when you participate in it. But, Dr. Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi, Jesus Christ, like, think these are the proper examples. Why? John Lennon, right? John Lennon said that, you know, they know how to deal with violence. They got the biggest, baddest machines out there. So, you know, the way to do it is to do stuff like that woman in Texas, who basically cut some hair. Like, you know, that's how you civil, you know, like, and, you know, and then they arrested her, and then the judge said, well, I'll let you off if you apologize for cutting your kid's hair. And she said, I ain't apologizing for trying to take care of my kids. It's crazy. And the people got behind her, and the judge let her off, and there was no riots, and there was no, you know, that's what we need to do, because what it does is it exposes the veneer, it gets rid of the fog of the mesmerization that he talked about, and it exposes them as the aggressors, it exposes them as the tyrants, them as the authoritarians, them as the abusers, oppressors, etc. But the minute we start getting out there and getting all offensive like people are doing, it is only going to, you know, justify them cracking down harder. So cannot do that. Cannot do that.
I think, talking about the riots, I think that we have to look at the genesis of these riots and maybe compare them to Ferguson and see who initiated these riots. Were they bought and paid for by George Soros? Because he's been known to do that kind of thing before. And then when you look at I saw a video this morning, or just a part of one, where they had broken into a big mall, an expensive mall, and were ransacking a lot of the stores. What is going on provides the lawless to do unlawful things, but it also sets up a situation where you can have a creative mob that serves a purpose. That because when you have a chaos, when you have a crisis, a chaos, that means you're going to give the police more power to come in and break that up. And so you have to question what you're seeing and figuring it out and evaluating to see, gosh, what is behind this?
Yeah, and there's been
reports. Who arranged this? Go ahead.
And there's been reports that a lot of the agitators and scares have been from out of state.
All right, yes.
Yeah, and, you know, let me just be clear. You know, by the way, you know, I've practiced martial arts for 20 years, all right? You know, I'm a stand-up fighter. I've done some amateur MMA and stuff. Not the best at choking people out, but I saw that. And when a guy's cuffed and he's on his chest, you got your knee on his, first of all, he's subdued. You don't need to have your knee on his neck. But the second part is when you're on him for 9 minutes, I mean, like that's, so for the people that are angry and, you know, don't think that I'm like trying to say to justify that. But what you're doing right now is going to enable those types of cops to come out and, you know, people saw, you know, when the lockdown was happening and people were going out and arresting, you know, moms that had their kids at the park. I mean, you know, people were like, what? You know, I mean, like,
oh my gosh.
But
yeah.
when you guys are burning stuff, stores down that had nothing to do with it, guess what? Now it looks like the police are, you know, doing what they need to be doing. Regardless, and, you know, at this point, you know, when they get rough, what are you going to say? Because you were burning stuff down. So this goes back to having an equal measure, you know, grammar, logic, rhetoric. Part of this whole concept of logic is that truth is non-contradictory, which means you should have an even measure. We used to call it the golden rule. So if it was wrong for that guy to use excessive force on George Floyd, it's wrong for you to use excessive force on other people's property, especially people that didn't have anything to do with
it. Yeah, do unto others, right. Okay, we'll be right back in 3 minutes. All right, welcome back. I think that last commercial is my favorite. He's talking about, John is talking about guns and things, and then he, at the end, he says, shoot him an email. I think that is so clever. I don't know if he did that on purpose or what. The other thing, too, that this whole COVID-19 has done, it has introduced the idea of scarcity. And when people fear that they're not going to be able to get whatever it is, toilet paper or whatever it is, they're going to feel some anxiety, and which will also make them very vulnerable to be obedient, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, you're seeing, I mean, you know, you're seeing that a lot. You know, one of the other prongs we might say that, you know, I said there's several people that can capitalize on this, and you see, you know, the food industry, you know, and, this big push for veganism and things like that now that, right, we have this big meat shortage. But in general, you know, the first time I walked into the store and saw, you know, basically empty shelves, you know, when there's no food, that's part of what the CARES Act money, by the way, I should mention that. You know, so I mentioned, you know, you're locked down and you're forced to take this money to keep your business open. Well, you know, a lot of, you know, that money comes with strings attached as well. So when you shut down the economy and you shut down the business, there's no way to get your own money. So they're going to give you money now. And when they give you money, that's going to come with strings attached where you have to push their agenda, right? And so, in education, it goes back to, all the stuff I talked about. There's a nice article. It's by Naomi Klein. It's Green New Deal. You know, I don't agree with what she says about how to handle the contact tracing. She seems to be a true believer in, let's just call it the hype. Let's just call it the hype of COVID. But I mean, her breakdown of this Green New Deal instead of the Green New Deal is all about, you know, all this ed tech stuff, but it's, you know, it's across the board, and, you know, she just added in there, so Governor Cuomo wants to build back better, and he's got a little, project called Reimagine Education and partners with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It's got Google's Eric Schmidt on the board. You know, and if you want to, if you got one idea of what they're going to do, just take a look at my website, schoolworldorder.info. There's 66 grants in the online bibliography from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that show he's financed everything from the corporate charter schools to the cradle to career workforce training to the public private P20 councils to the adaptive learning software. So, you know, yeah, when they give you that grant, that CARES grant money, you know, if you're starved out, you don't have, you can't get your own money. You can't. That's, you're going to have to use it for the adaptive or at least some form of virtual learning. And I should just throw this out there too. If you're a teacher, you're on a board or something, one of the ways you can push back on this is, you know, because look, my schools, they're not letting us back till the end of the year. It's just not happening. So what I'm trying to do is convince people that if we're going to pay out money to increase the online infrastructure, it should just be a virtual classroom that's synchronous. That means basically everybody logs in at the same time, and it's the same thing as being in a classroom, except instead of seeing each other in the same room, you're just looking through a screen. There's no data mining software that keeps a bunch of data from your students and you know, uses it to improve their products. There's no automation that's going to kick you out. And I'm sorry, I just ranted to the end of the show, Deanna. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's okay. You know, this just indicates we need to have you back.
Well, that would be nice. I would really like that.
Okay, so would I. Thank you so much for being on the program today. And thank you, listeners. Thank you so much. And we'll talk with you. Actually, next week I have a guest host. Anyway, I'll talk to you soon. Have a beautiful rest of the weekend. Bye-bye now. Thank you.